your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, The Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Welcome back, Crossover NBA Podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix? What's going on? We got 12 days to the trade deadline. It's exciting. I can feel the excitement in the air.
It is exciting. I wrote about that a little bit on Tuesday on SI.com. But can you just allow me a little space to vent here for a second about my alma mater, Boston College?
Yeah, as soon as I correct my math. 9 days, I think, till the trade deadline. Did I say 12? What did I say?
Anyway, you said 12.
Yes. Math is hard.
Just say less than 2 weeks.
There we go.
Covers all your bases. Little frustrated at my alma mater, which did not hire the guy I wanted them to hire, and that was Micah Shrewsbury, the former Celtics assistant coach. He had been working at Purdue. They hire Earl Grant, who is, no issue with Earl Grant, coach at Charleston. That's fine. But man, if Micah Shrewsbury, who was immediately hired by Penn State as their head coach, turns out to be the next great college basketball coach, I am never going to let BC forget it, ever. I'm going to keep hammering them on this because that was the guy with Boston ties, coached the Celtics, good coach, good recruiter. It was a frustrating couple of days for me, I gotta tell you.
How could Boston College ignore the wishes of you, its most famous alum? It's a scandal, frankly.
I'm at least in the top 2,000 of their famous alums. So
who's the most famous BC alum?
I can only think of basketball players right now. I mean, Dana Barros went to BC. Bill Curley was at BC. Our friend Jared Dudley, recovering from a knee injury. Good luck, Jared. Went to BC. So got some decent guys, but I need the basketball program to come back. I need it to be back to the levels it was at when I was in college.
I can only assume this means you will be withholding your millions of booster donors that you've been sending them for years, and that will send the message.
Yeah, that's millions. You and I have the same job, Howard.
No. You and I have a similar job. You also have like 17 other jobs, as I see you there in your DAZN sweatshirt. So.
Yes. Well, I mean, Bud Light's expensive nowadays. I got to be able to pay the bills when it comes to my beer supply. All right, let's jump into a few things. And I want to start with something you wrote on Monday, and that is the case for Chris Webber to make the Hall of Fame. Weber was among the dozen or so finalists named by the Hall last week, and he has become something of a polarizing figure when it comes to Hall of Fame credentials. There are people like yourself, and I'll let you kind of explain it, that believe he should be in the Hall of Fame. There are obviously people that don't, because he hasn't gotten in up until this point. So make the case for me, Howard, that Chris Weber should be in the Hall of Fame. And if you can, try to explain why he's not.
I wish I could explain why he isn't. And even in making the case for why I think he should be, I have to slap this massive freaking caveat on the entire discussion, which is, Chris, we don't know anything about how people get into the Hall of Fame. We know it's a...
How bizarre is that? I mean, how bizarre is that? Because, like, the other halls, I mean, at least the Baseball Hall of Fame, like, it's a big deal when ballots are revealed. Like, it's a big thing. Like, yeah. You're right. Yeah. I could not... When I emailed you earlier, I'm like, can you please explain how players are selected for the Hall of Fame? You're like, I don't know. Nobody knows.
It's maddening. So a couple things that people need to remember, or if you don't know, you should know about the Hall of Fame. It's the Basketball Hall of Fame, not the NBA Hall of Fame. So it's never just your NBA resume. So there are international players. There's both men and women. There is youth. There's coaches and players and broadcasters. And it's pulled from every single level of basketball around the world, because it's not the NBA Hall of Fame. So we always have to keep that in mind, both pro and con, because for some guys, it may hurt their resume if they had a really good NBA career but never won Olympic gold, or they didn't do anything big in college, or there's nothing else to round out. So sometimes it hurts you, but also it makes it hard to make apples to apples comparisons, because not everybody's there on the same basis. Some are there for their international play. Some are there because they excelled in a different league somewhere else. Again, men's game and women's game, college and pro. It's a mishmash. So you can never make across the board comparisons. And then the other caveat always is this, of course. We don't know who votes, how they vote, why they vote, what the standards are. If somebody has been, like, this finalists class also includes Michael Cooper, who won, what was it, like 5 championships with the Lakers. Role player in those teams, but a really important one. One of the all-time great perimeter defenders. And he's been eligible for like 30 years. Why is he a finalist now in 2021? Showtime was a long time ago. We can't answer these questions, Chris, because we don't know. Nobody knows. We will never know. All that said, all you can do when we have these discussions is make your best stab at comparing a player, especially NBA players, because that's what we cover. Make the best comparison you can to the guys in their era, at their position, and who made the Hall. So here's the thing with Chris Weber. I'm not even going to talk about the Michigan years, where he was part of iconic teams at Michigan, and they were trendsetters in so many ways, including just basketball fashion, among other things. And there's some scandal that goes with that, that he has to live down, but I don't think that should be on him. That should be on college basketball. That's a whole other discussion. But here's what he did. Here's the basic outline. Chris Weber finished with 17,182 points. I'm not going to get into the actual numbers. How about this? Over 17,000 points, over 8,000 rebounds, and over 3,500 assists. He's in the top 100 in points all time in the NBA. He's in the top 70 all time in rebounds in the NBA. For a league that's existed for, 75 years or something, those are pretty good standings overall in lifetime points and rebounds. And that's despite having a career that was cut short and where his last several years were dealing with knee injuries. How many players, Chris, do you think finished their NBA careers with at least 17,000 points, 8,000 rebounds, and 3,500 assists?
Bet it's a small number.
It's 14. Out of that 14, 10 are already in the Hall of Fame. That's Kareem, Wilt, Karl Malone, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, Charles Barkley, Larry Bird, Jason Kidd, John Havlicek, and Elgin Baylor. Of the other 4, one is LeBron, who will make the Hall, I believe. One is Dirk, who's not quite eligible yet, but will be, and will make it. And the other 2 are Pau Gasol and Chris Webber. And Pau's going to end up making it based on his international resume, in addition to his NBA time. So he's almost a certainty, I think. Don't you agree?
I agree. Pau, as part of those Spanish teams, will get In addition to a pretty decorated NBA career that ended with multiple championships,
sure.
He will get in the Hall of Fame.
Yes. So Powell's going to make it, and Dirk and LeBron are going to make it. So now 13 of the 14 with 17,000 points, 8,000 rebounds, and 3,500 assists will be in, all but Chris Webber, unless he makes it this year. Of course, if he doesn't make it this year, maybe he's back on the finalist pool next year. I don't know how that works either. If you were to add in steals and blocks, by the way, because he finished with 1,197 steals and 1,200 blocks, throw those in into the additional the points, rebounds, assists that I already threw out there, that 14 comes down to just four players, Chris Webber, along with Dirk, Garnett, and Kareem. If you want to take out blocks, because blocks weren't always recorded, put in just steals, so points, rebounds, assists, steals, it's nine players. Any way you look at it, he did things statistically over the course of his career that very few have done in the history of the NBA. And that's a really impressive list. But people will want to talk about, you know, they're either going to talk about the timeout that he didn't have. The number of timeout jokes I saw in my timeline yesterday on Twitter after tweeting out the story was just like ridiculous. Like, folks, get an original joke, okay? We know. He called a timeout they didn't have at Michigan. We get it.
In the championship game that he played a pretty significant role in getting his team there.
Yes. Yes. Never mind that he got them there. So, you know, it's that, and then it's, well, he couldn't get the Kings to the finals. He couldn't win the championship. Look, I covered that era very closely because I was a Laker beat writer during the three-peat that the Lakers had, and they played the Kings, I believe, all three of those seasons, all three of the championship years. I know how tough those Kings teams were. I know how much they pushed the Lakers to the limit. I know how brutal, first of all, how phenomenally entertaining those teams were. They were the mid-2000s Phoenix Suns before the Phoenix Suns. They were the Steph Curry Warriors before the Warriors, in a lot of ways. The ball movement, the three-point shooting, different era, different time, but like they were ahead of their time. They were up-tempo, they were free-flowing, they were so much fun, and they were also really, really freaking good. So a couple quick ones here before I finish my presentation for Chris on Chris Webber's behalf here. So the Kings averaged 56 wins from 2000 to 2005. So it's a half decade of being a top tier team. This is kind of like the Lob City Clippers, right? Where you don't know how to deal with them, but they had like the second or third best record for a 5-year span. And half a decade is a long time in the NBA. Kings averaged 56 wins for that 5-year span, including 61 wins, the most in the league in 2001-02. They make the conference semis four times, the conference finals once. Of course, that is the famous or infamous series where they lose overtime, game seven at home. The Lakers go on to beat the Nets for their third championship. And there's the controversy of the officiating in game six. There's the Kings just kind of gagging in overtime of game seven. But this is a team that was among the best in the league for a 5-year run, but they're operating at the same time as the Shaq and Kobe Lakers, the Nowitzki Steve Nash Mavericks, the Duncan Robinson Spurs. That's Tim Duncan and David Robinson, not Duncan Robinson of the Heat. Among other brutal eras of the Western Conference, this was a really elite era, and they were right there. They were as good as any of them. And Chris Webber, I put this stat in the story. Chris Webber, over his best 9-year span, right? This is when he's healthy, before the knee injury and the knee surgery, and this is once he's kind of hit his stride, right? But a 9-year run, again, 9 years of dominance in the NBA is a very long time. From 94 to 03, he averages 22.8 points, 10.4 rebounds, 4.6 assists, 1.6 steals, and 1.6 blocks. The number of players who matched that during that 9-year span, none. None. Take out the steals and blocks, make it just points, rebounds, assists, still none. He's the only guy who averaged those stats. If you want to make it just scoring and rebounding, take out the assists, but the playmaking was a big part of what made him great. If it's just points and rebounds, the only two guys on the list with him in that 9-year span are Tim Duncan and Shaquille O'Neal. He was that freaking good. And power forward was elite back then. That was a glamour position. You've got Nowitzki, Garnett, Charles Barkley, Rasheed Wallace, Karl Malone, Sean Kemp, Jermaine O'Neal. Like, he was as talented as any of them. Was he as tough as any of them, maybe? No. Was he as defensive-minded? No. He might have had the best all-around skill set. As Robert Horry told me in my story, Rob, of course, guarded all of them a lot. He might have had the most complete skill set of all of them. And the Kings might have broken through if not for a weird series in 2002, or if not for having to deal with Shaq and Kobe. If they go, they're definitely beating the Nets. He's got a ring, and he's probably already in. But rings culture can't decide who gets in the Hall. Like, it's the totality of your career. There are plenty of guys in the Hall without rings. Like, we could go on all day about the guys in the Hall who don't have rings. So there's the basic. And by the way, the basics, yes, All-NBA five times, including a first and 3 seconds in All-NBA. Five-time All-Star. Could have made more, but he was at a stacked position, as we just went over. Or he would have had even more of those. And last thing, because somebody's going to say, well, how do you, you know, he was pretty good. He should be in the Hall of pretty good. Okay, fine. But Tracy McGrady and Grant Hill both went in recent years. And Chris Webber played way more playoff games than both of them, was the centerpiece of all of those playoff teams that he was on. And you know, like Tracy McGrady didn't even win a playoff series until he was the 15th man for the Spurs in 2013, going to the finals as a spectator, basically. So how is Tracy McGrady in and Chris Webber isn't? I don't know. And that's not knocking McGrady. McGrady was freaking awesome. I'm just saying, wherever the bar is, it is set to a point where Tracy McGrady and Grant Hill can make it in, but somehow Chris Webber can't. His stats and career achievements are as good or better than theirs.
Two things I wonder about with this sort of anonymous committee or whoever is making these decisions. Are they taking into account what Webber did at Michigan, or are they following the letter of the law that says that the two Michigan Final Fours were vacated because Chris Webber committed the unforgivable sin of taking money from Ed Martin, which, I mean, player takes money in college basketball is just not breaking news. I'm sorry. No. I think that if I was part of the voting committee, I would be taking into account what Webber did at Michigan. And what he did at Michigan, in addition to the accomplishment, you touched on this, he and the rest of the Fab Five were trendsetters in so many ways. They were pioneers in so many ways in college basketball and should get a lot of credit for that. And Webber should get the respect and the credit that comes with being part, the leader, really, of that group. I also, and you touched on this, look back at the 0-2 conference finals, and I'm sure you were there for it as Lakers beat writer. Game 6 of the conference finals might have been the worst officiated game I've ever seen. Like, ever. And yeah, there have been some allegations of corruption. I'm not going to get into any of that. But, you know, it really felt like the Kings got hosed in that game. It did, from watching it, from what I remember of it. I went back and watched some clips of it before we did this podcast. They win that series, I'm with you. They beat the Nets in the finals. Webber's got a ring, and we're probably not having this discussion right now. But if I'm the committee, I've got to take those two things into account, that look, they were on the cusp and were beaten by both the referees and a great dynasty in the Lakers, and Webber was part of something special at the University of Michigan. Those two things, when you factor them in with all the numbers you've laid out there, it seems like a no-brainer that Webber should be in the Hall of Fame.
And I've always said this about officiating, so I'm going to be consistent with this. I always say, look, there are games, and maybe even series, but there are times when the officiating affects things, right? You can't deny it. Like, whether it's mistakes, whether you want to believe there's something else going on. I don't believe any of the conspiracy theories. I think it's all bullshit. But sometimes a game turns based on a call or two, whatever. And I will always say, not with regard to that series, but in general, there's still a million other things that happen in the course of a game or a playoff series that are in your control. So I'm not going to say the Kings lost a championship opportunity because of the officiating in Game 6 of the 2002 conference finals. What I'm going to say is you had Game 7 at home and you let it go to overtime and you gagged badly in overtime. So it's still on you. I'm not going to let the Kings off the hook for that. However, Game 6 did happen. It was one of these weird events that we are still talking about almost 20 years later. And we can't ignore it entirely, but again, the totality of his career, it shouldn't require a championship because we haven't required it of anybody else. And he was the most important player on those teams. It was a real ensemble cast, right? Those were really fun teams because of everybody, right? Vlade was a great passer, so he and Chris Webber could go high-low, and there's all this great passing out of the post with both of them. And Mike Bibby, Peja Stojakovic, Hedo Turkoglu, Doug Christie, like all of those guys played a role, but Chris Webber was by far the most important one in that group. And so part of the thing that maybe hurts him is he doesn't stand out in the same way because we looked at them as the ensemble cast, but he's the reason they were great. And even in his time, he didn't get enough consideration, I thought, even in the MVP race, because they were viewed as the ensemble kind of approach. But if you look at his career, like he did make some MVP ballots. I think his highest finish ever was fourth, which, okay, you were in the conversation for best player in the league. That was in 2000-2001. He finished fourth. He had two other seventh-place finishes, a ninth and a tenth. So those are all years that everybody acknowledged that he was a deserving at least of some third, fourth, fifth-place type votes because he was that great. And the Michigan thing, look, I think you and I agree on this. Like, that is just college basketball. Clean up college basketball before you start punishing players for their careers and for accepting money or whatever. We know it goes on all the time. We know most of the time it doesn't get caught. It doesn't get adjudicated. And so most guys get off, go scot-free on that stuff. But also, like, that's a prime example of, like, hating the player. Hate the game, not the player. It's the system that's set up. He just benefited from it. Go fix this damn system first before you then take it out on him. And there's nobody on earth aside from the NCAA at the most official level, and maybe the people voting on the Hall of Fame too, who are going to say that those Final Four appearances didn't exist. Okay, they're vacated by a technicality. Nobody in the world of sports fandom or sports media believes those don't exist. They happened. For those of us who are alive, we saw it happen. So
yeah, I remember reading Mitch Albom's book on the Fab Five back in the mid-90s. And, like, I mean, I remember reading his sections where, you know, the Fab Five would travel from city to city, and the amount of money that was made off them, like baggy shorts, baggy everything. I mean, Nike, Michigan, everybody's cleaned up off of them. So I'm sorry, I'm not going to get worked up about allegations of Chris Webber or anybody else taking money from a booster. I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it. Not going to do it. All right, read more about Howard's case for Chris Webber. That's up on SI.com right now. We're going to get into the trade deadline more next week, Howard. But as you survey the landscape, you know, there's a lot of teams bunched up in the middle, some good teams, especially in the Western Conference, where you have Denver and Portland, and Utah's scuffled a little bit in the last couple of days, kind of letting teams close the gap there. As you kind of look at the field in both conferences, is there a team out there that you see that needs to make a deal? I think there are a lot of teams that want to make a deal and want to kind of nibble around the fringes a little bit. But is there a team out there you think needs to win a deal for whatever reason?
Yeah, it's funny. So I was looking at this, Chris, and as you and I know, and this is part of why the trade deadline, it could either be spectacular, fireworks, a bazillion deals, or there might be almost nothing, because everybody thinks they're in it right now. The combination of this weird season, tons of mediocrity across the league, uncertainty, plus the play-in games. Now all you have to do is make 10th, and you've got a shot to make the playoffs through the play-in game.
That's a big part of all of this entire next few weeks. And that there's basically everybody but the last team in each conference has a, you know, kind of a mathematical shot of getting in there.
Yeah, and so I don't know that, you know, if everybody thinks that they're buyers and there's only four sellers, that could be a problem. Maybe some teams convince themselves or decide, you know what, we're not gonna convince ourselves. Let's just face reality. Sure, we can make the 10th spot and make the play-in game. What's the point? Like, some teams will be having those reality checks soon, and maybe we'll still see a lot of deals because there are a lot of teams with a lot of players that either want out or the teams know that they don't have a future there. Like, the list, more than any other time I can remember, Chris, the list of players going into the trade deadline that have rumors around them of possibly being on the market or being in play, it's longer than ever. And they still might not all get moved, or very, very few might because of the situation across the league. But so rather than look at a team that I thought really needs to make a deal because they need to shore up their championship prospects, or they're on the fringes of the playoff race and they're trying to secure their seventh or eighth spot or something, I'm looking at the other side. I'm looking at Orlando. Orlando needs to make a trade because it's the other direction. This is a team that's been on cruise control for years with the same basic core group that has done nothing. They have one winning record in the last nine seasons, and it was 42-40, like the lowest possible winning record. 42-40 in 2018-19. That's it in 9 years. So I don't want to hear that Vucevic is some core player who's untouchable and they got to keep him. I don't want to hear that, you know, they're really attached to Evan Fournier and they want to extend him or something. Like, I don't even want to hear that Jonathan Isaac and Markelle Fultz are supposedly their core guys going forward. Really? because I've seen that written. I believe that that's what they're saying, but Markelle Fultz has never really accomplished much. I mean, good story that he's revived his career. He's going to be, I think, a solid player. And Jonathan Isaac, once he gets healthy, was emerging as a kind of a defensive player of the year type. Like, he's that talented defensively. But these aren't guys who you're saying, like, this is our franchise's future. They might be really good pieces, but come on. There's nothing more frustrating than watching a team spin its wheels and be on that treadmill of mediocrity, as Kevin Pritchard dubbed it years ago. And the Magic, if you can sell off these pieces, finally sell Aaron Gordon, sell, trade him for prospects, picks, whatever. Trade Evan Fournier. Trade anybody. Trade all of them. Trade some of them. Pick a different path, because the path you're on doesn't even look like a path. It just looks like you're wandering in the woods.
Yeah, I agree on Orlando. And I've been told that they are operating like a team more motivated than ever to move off some of these players, beginning with Aaron Gordon and Evan Fournier. Vucevic is also available. The two guys that are not, the guys you mentioned who are both injured, not all that appealing right now anyway, and that's Fultz and Jonathan Isaac. So if you can just make deals to get off those contracts, well, you're probably doing yourself a favor in the long term. The team I'm looking at, though, is the LA Clippers. The Clippers have two guys that are great. Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Kawhi's an MVP candidate. Paul George has played this season on that next level. They're right there. But I think they need a point guard. Like, I watched those games and I watched that team, and Patrick Beverley and Lou Williams just don't feel like enough. Especially when it comes to playmaking. Beverly is shooting the three pretty well. He's obviously a great defensive player. Lou Williams, while not the prolific scorer he's been in years past, is still giving you 10, 12 points per game coming off the bench. But neither one of them is playmaking. Beverly's averaging 2 assists per game. That's a career low. You've got Lou Williams averaging like 3, a little over 3. That's not getting the job done either. I think they have to go out and find somebody that can either supplement those guys or replace them in the rotation. Now, I've been saying for months now that the Clippers have had interest in Terry Rozier. I'm not sure how that happens at this point, because Rozier's having a career season right now in Charlotte. He has been great for the Hornets this year, and the Hornets are right there in the thick of the playoff mix. I don't think Charlotte's going to look to just dump Terry Rozier while their team is, battling for a mid-playoff spot. But it's got to be somebody. Ricky Rubio is certainly available. Maybe that's someone that they kick the tires on. I think they've got to get one more piece, Howard. If not, I just think whether it's the Lakers or the Jazz or somebody else, they're going to run into a team that takes advantage of their lack of playmaking, of their lack of their inability to kind of score in transition and have somebody that goes up and down. That's a weakness for this team. Yeah. So I'm looking at the Clippers to need to make a deal over the next couple of weeks to cement their status as a real title contender.
Yeah, no, look, I agree. Now, is there a scenario, or can we conceive of this Clippers team with no changes at all, still winning the West, winning a championship? Yeah, it's possible. Paul George and Kawhi Leonard are that good. They've got great role players around them. Like, they're a really good team. The record says it. They've had some weird ups and downs this season. Some of that may be due to the lack of playmaking or a playmaking point guard in that mix. But, there's a scenario where they win anyway. But yeah, your job is to make sure that you give yourself the best possible chance. They'd have a better chance if they had Kyle Lowry, who I don't think they can get, right? Like, I've been floating that one since October, I think. I don't think they can get Kyle Lowry. I love the fit there. If there were a way to do it,
I don't know how anybody gets Kyle Lowry. But I was asking around on this. It's just so hard to make the money work without gutting your team.
I know.
It's
the NBA. I wish the NBA could come up with one other. Not that we need yet another page in the CBA or another formula to make things more complicated. But Kyle Lowry, what is he making? $30 million. So the salary matching makes it really, really hard. And I feel like, could we have one more tweak where if it's $30 million, but it's an expiring deal, so there's really only like, 15 left on it or whatever, can we have some kind of like mathematical adjustment to make it easier to make trades? That's what I'm saying. I don't know. Dan Rube, go figure it out, please. it is because Toronto has reason to want to move him. I don't know that they're like, I'm not reading minds. I don't know that they want to. I'm saying there's good reason to. And there are plenty of teams that would love to have him. But making the money work, making the cap matching, the salary cap matching stuff is just really tough. I mean, what about a lesser piece? You mentioned Rubio. What about, you know, like George Hill's hurt right now. I don't know when he's due back, but you know, George Hill's sitting there languishing in Oklahoma. Do you think there is a less flashy move than a Kyle Lowry trade that could still satisfy what they need at that position, be the upgrade from Beverly and Lou Williams, and actually move the needle enough to make a difference in a playoff series?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Rubio makes the most sense because Rubio does things that Williams and Beverly don't, and that's move the ball. Like, he's one of the best pure passers at that position still, I think, in the NBA. So, you know, while he, you know, I don't think he'd step in and immediately be the starter with that team, but if you're looking for somebody to keep the ball moving, to get out in transition, that's the guy. I mean, George Hill is a knockdown shooter. Like, I think he's that with a lot of playoff experience. But is he markedly different as a playmaker than Beverly or Lou Williams? I don't know. I think when it comes to playmaking, Rubio's the guy that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's available, you know, at this point, as you know, Minnesota's not going anywhere. But, again, the Clippers, their biggest problem is that they made their deals.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have draft assets to trade you. They do have a bunch of second-round picks that they can use in deals, and maybe that's all you need to get Rubio off. But, like, their contract situation are tough to make deals. Like, they're just in a weird spot right now.
That's the issue. They don't have anything to trade, Chris, and you know their cap is what it is. Like, where I don't know how you figure that out. And maybe they're a trade, or maybe they're a buyout market team in terms of point guard. Maybe George Hill gets bought out and maybe he ends up there. I don't know. You know, I don't know if there are any other point guards who are going to be on the market. And you're right. Like, George Hill's not your prototypical playmaking point, so maybe he's not the right fit. But I think he's still an upgrade.
Yeah, no, I think George Hill would be an upgrade, and he would give you a different dimension as well with his shooting and the things he can do in the half court. I just like the idea of Rubio in that mix a lot more. Let's finish with more MVP conversation, because this is going to be a wild race all year long. Our friends over at Inside the NBA had a good discussion last week about Chris Paul's candidacy, where you had, what was it, Kenny Smith making the case? Was he the one that was arguing for Chris Paul?
Charles, I think, brought it up first, and then
Charles did. Yeah,
Kenny Shaq and Shaq both. Yep, Shaq pushed back hard. Kenny kind of pushed back, but Kenny felt bad that, why are you putting me in a position where I have to make it sound like I'm hating on Chris Paul? Which I disagree with Kenny on that. Even like, you can push back on Chris Paul's candidacy for MVP without sounding like you're putting him down. Like, chill.
Yeah. So the question is, you know, we'll kind of expand on this a little bit, but to me, Chris Paul, there are a lot of things you can say about Chris Paul this year. First of all, he's been a great fit in Phoenix. They have elevated in part because of what Chris Paul's been able to do as a playmaker, a fourth quarter scorer, just a guy taking pressure off of Devin Booker in that lineup. He's also worth every nickel of the contract he signed that so many people thought would be an albatross on whatever team's neck was getting it. And look, he signed the deal with Houston. I think Houston would probably love to do that one over again to get their picks back and to get Chris Paul back and see if he can make it work with James Harden. Oklahoma City, great season there. Got them into the playoffs and was a terrific mentor for some of the young guards like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Lou Dort, and others with that team. And now he's in Phoenix and he's got them, you know, at or near the top of the Western Conference standing. So Chris Paul's been great. There are a lot of positives you can say about Chris Paul. The MVP stuff, though, I just think he's a cut below. I think he's, you know, certainly an all-star, having a great year. But one thing you have to remember, I think, about the Phoenix Suns is that they went 8-0 in the bubble last year. They were really good at the end of last season. They were trending in this direction. Now, going 8-0 in the bubble isn't the same as being the number two team in the Western Conference, but without any changes, I think you can make the case that the Suns would be in the playoff mix without Chris Paul. He's made them better, no question about it, but it's not like they were the old Phoenix Suns, this moribund franchise that wasn't going anywhere. Chris Paul elevated them, but they were heading down that pathway. So those to me are like the arguments against Chris Paul being in an MVP race, which, as we know, is incredibly tight right now. I mean, Joel Embiid's recent injury opens the door for somebody else, whether it's LeBron or Nikola Jokic or even Giannis, who could be making his way back into the mix. I just don't see Chris Paul getting there based on what I've seen in the first half of the season. What about you, Howard?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Charles was right to bring him up, but I don't think he can be top of the ballot. He probably can't be top of the ballot because the standard in most years is so, so high. You have to have the gaudiest of gaudy stats. Look at what Giannis was putting up the last couple of years in winning it. Look what James Harden put up. Look what Russell Westbrook put up. Look at what Steph Curry put up. All the recent MVPs, it's almost a prerequisite that you have to have not just like averaging 28, 30 points a game, but you've got to be posting a ton of assists and rebounds. You got to be shooting at a really high percentage, really high efficiency. And your team has to be great. It's like the standard's really high, and it should be for the most part. I don't mind Charles bringing up Chris Paul. And I touched on this in my piece yesterday too, in the morning shoot around. I think he's right to bring him up, and I think we should talk about him. It doesn't mean I'll put him at the top of the ballot when it comes time to vote, but I think he's probably at this point on the ballot somewhere. It's getting harder and harder because the number of guys who are worthy of talking about, discussing, being in the conversation somewhere on the ballot, it's like it could be 8 to 12 players. There's only 5 slots. That's a lot. That's a lot of worthy candidates. But here's the case for him. The Suns are one of the best teams in the league by record, and they're one of the best teams in the West, which is, as usual, really tough. They're 26-12 as we record this, second only to the Jazz. And if you go league-wide, the only other team with a better record than them is Philly. So they've got the third best record in the NBA. And so then you say, well, okay, if the MVP is on one of the best teams, that's normally a prerequisite, and is one of the best players on that team, or the best player, now you get down to, well, is it really Devin Booker or Chris Paul? Well, Devin Booker was there last year, and they were not a playoff team. Yes, I know they were 8-0 in the bubble, as you point out, but they still fell well short of the playoffs. Chris Paul is the difference. Chris Paul has taken them from being a team that's been out of the playoffs for 10 years, and in one half season so far, has transformed them to a team that has the third best record in the NBA right now. Now, it doesn't show up in the box score much. He doesn't score a ton. Assists are up there, but not off the charts. He's efficient, but not hyper-efficient. He's still a really good defender. His influence, his leadership, all those are the things. There's a lot of intangibles that make it like that's where the MVP case becomes. Like it becomes about the things that are really hard to identify or quantify. But the analogy, of course, is still Steve Nash, another Suns point guard from the, whatever it's been now, 15 years. Mid-2000s, Steve Nash comes in and transforms them. They win, they had a 33-win gain, I think, from the year before to his first season there. They become one of the best teams in the NBA. Steve Nash averages 15.5 points and becomes MVP because he also led the league in assists, and he's viewed as the guy who transformed that Suns team. So there's a loose analogy there. It's not perfect, but it's compelling, and it's worth talking about.
Speaking of talking about, are we going to have to talk about Giannis at some point?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, he just finished kicking the crap out of Washington in back-to-back games, where he shot like 60-plus from the field, 50% from three. I'm looking at the numbers right now. 33-11 in the game on Saturday, 31-15 with 10 assists in the game on Monday. His numbers from last season, Howard, are basically identical, and he's trending upward right now. He's starting to play better basketball. And it seems like Mike Budenholzer has gotten over the idea of limiting Giannis to like 32 minutes per game. He has been well over that in many of the games he's played in the last couple of months, and frankly, most of the season, even. If he keeps playing like this and the Bucks finish top two in the East, what do we do? Like, Giannis with these same numbers, Howard, was a landslide winner last year.
Yeah.
I understand there's more competition, and you and I, we disagree on voter fatigue. I think it's there. You don't necessarily agree with me. But if he puts up the same these types of numbers for the rest of the year and plays all the games, and the Bucks are a top two team, I don't know, man. It's a regular season award. You vote at the end of the regular season, and it's going to be hard to argue that anybody's had a better regular season than Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Here are the things that the MVP should not be about. It shouldn't be about how you performed in the playoffs, because it's a regular season award. It's about what you do from game one through game, in this case, 72, of the regular season. It has nothing to do with what you did last year, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. It has nothing to do with whether you failed in the playoffs. It has nothing to do with anything other than the present season. That's it. It's a seasonal award. So if we took what he's doing in a vacuum, of course he should be there. But I will say this. I want to give a different definition. It wouldn't be voter fatigue that he does that would keep him from winning it a third straight year. It would be the fact, as we talked about on a previous podcast, that winning three in a row is an honor in itself. It's almost like you're voting on a different award, because only three guys in NBA history have won three in a row, and no one since Larry Bird.
You keep doing that, though. Like, is that...
Should
that matter? Like, shouldn't it be in a vacuum?
It should be. Ideally, it should be. But I also think, like, if you make a guy an MVP three straight years, you are now immediately elevating him into an all-timer discussion. And so it does feel like a different exercise in some respects. Is that fair to Giannis in the season he's having? No. Intellectually, I cannot say otherwise. Like, it is unfair to him to say you can't win MVP this year, because it would put you in a category with Wilt Chamberlain and Larry Bird and Bill Russell, and you don't belong there yet. That doesn't feel right, but it is a different honor to win it three straight years. Then, like, it's almost like it's a different award. Here's the three straight year award, right? I'm going to keep thinking about it over the course of the next couple of months, because I'm a bit of a purist about this. I do believe it should be about just the current season. And so there's a really strong case for him right now. Now, the Bucks also slipped a little, right? So part of what's depressed his MVP stock and all of these week-to-week odds is that the Bucks aren't as dominant. One of the reasons that he won it the last 2 years is because they had the best record in the league. That mattered.
Which they could still do that.
And if they do it, we are going to be tying ourselves in knots, because it's going to be really difficult to deny him again. But look, I want to point this out too while we're on it. This race keeps evolving. A week ago, Joel Embiid was considered the clear favorite. He's now going to be out for 2 to 3 weeks with that knee injury, missing somewhere from, like, guessing 8 to 12 games. He'd already missed 7. By the time he comes back, there's a pretty good chance he'll have missed close to 20 games in a 72-game season. That is a massive chunk. They say, you know, the best ability is availability. And in the MVP race, I don't think anybody's ever missed that number of games or that percentage of the season and won it. You have to be available. LeBron's played, like, every game but one. That helps him. Jokic, I think, has played every game. Pretty sure every game.
Most of the games. Very high number.
I don't think Giannis has missed a game. Dame Lillard, I don't think, maybe won somewhere along the way. Like, I didn't look up everybody's missed games, but the guys who haven't missed games are going to have an advantage if they have the right stats and the right win total, because it matters that you're available. Joel Embiid, I'm going to say it right now, it's going to be very, very hard for him to be top of the ballot if he misses 20 out of 72 games. And then meanwhile, Jimmy Butler is poking his head into this thing. Now, Jimmy Butler, should caveat right off the top, he's missed 14 games. He can't afford to miss many more at all. Not to be top of the ballot. You can still be on the ballot. Embiid will still be on the ballot. But I think it's harder to be the top if you've missed too much of the season. But Jimmy Butler's balling out. Jimmy Butler's averaging almost 22 points, 7.5 rebounds, and 8 assists. Like, he's been phenomenal. The Heat are now top 4 in the East. And they have gone on their biggest run and revived their season since he returned at the end of January. So Jimmy Butler belongs in this discussion too. Again, doesn't mean it's top of the ballot, but he's in there. And just to complete this list, LeBron, Giannis, Harden, Lillard, Jokic, Embiid, Butler, Chris Paul for the sake of discussion, Kawhi, Curry, Doncic, and your guy Gobert, because you've argued for him in this discussion. That's 12 players we could make a plausible case for, again, if not the top of the ballot, then somewhere on the ballot, which only has 5 slots. Some of these guys are not going to get on there.
Hey, look, it's going to be a wild finish to the MVP race, and I'm just going to say it right now. After the votes are cast and they're made public, I'm blocking off Twitter for a week. I don't want to hear your ballot sucks, because we know that's coming.
You're a hater, Chris. You hate everybody's favorite teams. It's unfair.
Yes,
you're a bad person because of it. It's probably because of your East Coast bias or your Boston bias.
Don't forget, Jaylen Brown's going to be on the MVP ballot, so he'll be top five on mine, obviously. Howard, good to talk to you, man. We'll do it next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.